Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How should college change along with the population of students seeking education? Many American universities are set up to accommodate students whose parents had the means to pay tuition, allowing young scholars to focus their full attention on their studies. Today, a greater percentage of students in college are taking out massive loans to pay their own way through school, and many of them are working long hours to support themselves and, in some cases, their young families at the same time. My guests today explore this phenomenon and how some universities are responding to it in an American Radio Works documentary called The New Face of College. Laura Stern and Samara Freemark are co-producers of the special, which you can hear this coming Sunday, September 28th at 5 in the afternoon on KERA. They join us as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Samara and Laura, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris. We're happy to be here. And it's Lori.
Lori, excuse me. I'm so sorry, Lori. I'm so sorry. I'm thinking about my sister, Laura. For college graduates who maybe haven't been on campus in a decade or more, what's different about the student bodies of schools today?
Well, you know, the whole nation is undergoing just this massive demographic change, as I'm sure being in Texas, you guys are very aware. And that's hitting higher education as it is everywhere. You know, colleges were kind of built to serve a really particular kind of student. And that student, you know, the white student, the young student, the student who can afford to go to college, that student's disappearing. And higher ed is having to adapt.
Colleges were organized around the needs of students who could be presumed to have a lot more resources than many students today.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Continue. I'm sorry.
Yeah, this is Lori. I was going to say that it depends what campus you go on, what you'll see. Many campuses still, well, some campuses still accommodate the so-called traditional student, particularly private schools like in the Ivy League. But if you go on public schools or schools that specifically serve non-traditional students, you'll see lots of part-timers. Maybe some daycare facilities, and many, many students of color.
And for many of these students, the biggest impediment, not surprisingly, turns out to be money. Samara, can you tell us a little bit about Amber Ortiz-Diaz and how she sort of embodies this new breed of college student?
Sure. I should say for this documentary, we visited three different schools, University of Texas, El Paso, Amherst College, which is an elite school in the Northeast. And then I went to a school called Heritage University, which is this very small private liberal arts institution really in the middle of nowhere in eastern Washington, about as isolated as you could get. And while I was there, I met a student named Amber. Amber's the child of migrant farm workers from Michoacán in Mexico. And she grew up working in the fields with her family. She was picking apples and cherries and knew that that was not the life that she wanted for herself. And she always thought she might want to pursue higher education, but she didn't really have a model for that. Her parents, I think, had a second grade education and a fourth grade education. They couldn't help her with her homework. They didn't speak English. And so she just had no basis for thinking about how to begin looking for higher ed. She also got pregnant when she was 17, and so she became a single teen mother. She has a little boy named Jaden. And so it didn't look good for her in terms of managing to go to college. But luckily for her, there was this small college called Heritage right in her backyard. And so she ended up enrolling in Heritage. And, you know, she is very different from what we think of when we think of the college student that we see in the movies or that we have kind of in our mental image. You know, she's a little bit older. She took a little bit of time off. She has a 4-year-old son. She is a single mother. She lives with her sister and her father in a trailer. She works a couple of other jobs. And so she faces a lot more challenges than you know, the student who might go straight on to school, be supported by their parents, have nothing else to do but study.
I thought what was so interesting about her story was this idea that her family couldn't really help her so much academically because they didn't have the background themselves. But they could help her understand that education was her one sure route to a different kind of life.
Well, that's what she told me, that her father would always say to her, you know, he'd say basically, you have a choice. You can be in the fields, or you can search out education. And if you don't search out education, this is where you're going to spend your life, picking cherries. And he somehow knew that, even though that was not a life that he had had for himself.
So I guess you both met students who talked about the challenges of the application process. And I was thinking back on my own college career. I have very little memory of this, so I'm pretty sure my parents took the reins. But they're college educated themselves, and so they sort of knew how to navigate that territory.
Yeah, I mean, this is Samara again. I think back on my own experience applying for college, and you know, my family is highly educated. They both have actually have degrees that go beyond college, and they could totally guide me through that process, which is actually a very complicated process. I mean, between the applications for college itself, it's very, very confusing, especially if you've never done that and you're surrounded by people who have no experience with it. And maybe your guidance, the guidance counselor system in your school is not set up to really help kids go through it, because most kids don't end up going to college. And then, of course, there's the financial aid picture. Those FAFSA forms are ridiculously complicated, especially if your parents don't speak English, if you're not really... If you really need someone to hold your hand through that, it's almost impossible to do on your own. And that's what we see. Some of the colleges we looked at actually have really focused on helping high schoolers navigate that process, working from before the students actually show up on the doors of the college, helping them through the application process and helping them complete those FAFSA forms, and just even getting them to the point where they could consider enrolling.
So for non-traditional students, or students who've come from more challenged backgrounds, there are also some ethical questions about, do we take this student if we're fairly certain he or she will not succeed, because there are major bills and student debt stays with you whether or not you leave with a degree?
Oh, man, this is like the million-dollar question, I think. Because on one hand, you want everyone to have access to higher education, because higher education is generally good for people. People who have college degrees have higher earnings. They have lower unemployment. There are all these other benefits that accrue to people who have college degrees. Voting rates are higher. Families seem happier. It's great for the nation for people to have college education. But it's not necessarily that great if people go to college and it takes them 8 years and maybe they don't even complete their degree and they end up saddled with tens of thousands of dollars of student debt. So this is really, I think this is maybe the fundamental question, one of the fundamental questions that a lot of the schools, UTEP, Heritage, especially in our documentary, are struggling with, is how do you balance those two things? Because it's very, very difficult for the students that we are talking about, the non-traditional students. It's really hard for them to complete school in 4 years. You know, if you have a kid at home, if you have a mother who gets sick and you have to drop out to take care of her, if you have a car that breaks down and you can't afford to fix it so you can go to class, if all of a sudden you get kicked out of your house and you can't pay rent and you're homeless, I mean, it's almost impossible to complete college in 4 years. Even 6 years is a stretch. And so then you can end up in a situation where you're taking a lot of time to go to school, and those bills can really add up. And I think that's something that a lot of schools are struggling with.
So you mentioned
go ahead. Sorry, please. This is Lori. I would say that not only the campuses we visited, but the campuses we researched are determined to figure out a way to make sure that when a freshman enters the campus, he or she's prepared. And that might mean working with community college or, in the case of Amherst, a summer program that orients incoming freshmen, especially from low-income backgrounds. But at UTEP, their mission is access plus excellence. And there had been a time when UTEP was more selective, but now if you've graduated high school in Texas, you can be assured of going there. And if once you go there, you can be assured that the administration, the teachers, the peers will do everything they can to hold your hand and make sure that you proceed at whatever pace you're able toward a degree.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is sort of one, it's a global problem, but, because the whole system, the financial aid system, the way we assess the value of colleges, the way we rank colleges, the way we calculate graduation rates, all of those things are set up under the assumption that students are going to be able to complete in 4 or 6 years. And that's just not the kind of student we're talking about anymore.
Or the kind of economy.
Right.
And then for some, even if they do finish with a degree, that doesn't necessarily guarantee they will walk into a highly paid job. They might be doing really entry-level work for several years.
Sure, that's true. Though the numbers do, in the aggregate, seem to bear out the idea that college is generally, you know, not for everybody, but generally college seems to really help you in the market. But it's true. I mean, I do not want to minimize the fact that there are a lot of people out there struggling under their debt that they built up through going to college.
This is a bit of a tangent, but American Radio Works just did a podcast with an author. He wrote Academically Adrift a few years ago, and his new book, which follows a cohort of 2009 graduates, is called Aspiring Adults Adrift. Hmm. And he kind of puts the blame on some campuses for making themselves so attractive because, let's face it, campuses are competing for tuition dollars and for students these days and not emphasizing academics enough. So that one of his conclusions, his name is Richard Arum, is that students who were not challenged in their undergraduate years are not doing as well in the workforce. That's just something that think about as colleges think about where to put their scarce dollars.
It is sort of a strange thing now that so many college campuses, including some state universities, are very much like living at a country club for 4 years or 6 years, as the case may be. And then you get back out into the real world and it doesn't really jive with what you've gotten used to.
Right. No free gym memberships, no dining hall.
But the flip side of that, as we saw at University of Texas, El Paso, is that a big part of the preparation is to take these students who come from a pretty insular community and prepare them to go out and compete nationally and globally and they call it implicit bias there. I'm guessing that's a pretty obvious term, to not take that inferiority mindset that they still encounter out into the world with them to get over it.
So the idea being that essentially you learn to be comfortable in these kinds of situations that you'll encounter in the professional world.
Yeah. And that's different on different campuses. And for these campuses that are like at Heritage and UTEP that are largely so-called non-traditional students, they're people, including the president of UTEP, who have problems with that term. That's a big thing to learn in college, is how to see yourself as viable in the world.
We're speaking this hour with two producers of the new American Radio Works documentary, The New Face of College, Lori Stern and Samara Freemark. You can listen to the entire documentary when it airs Sunday, September 28th at 5 o'clock on KERA 90.1. If you'd like to join our conversation now, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
It's especially though that kind of learning that has that emotional quality to it, okay? It helps us stay alive.
Professor Castaneda's psychobiology class meets Wednesday evenings to accommodate students with jobs. About 40 students, many of them long past their 20s, take notes as he zooms through a PowerPoint about the anatomy of the brain.
What's the function of the basal ganglia? One word.
Motor.
Evening classes like this are another way UTEP keeps campus accessible. Gary Edens is vice president for student affairs.
And if you're going to open your doors and be an access institution, it's not about just come and we'll take your tuition money. No, it's about come and we're going to support you to graduation. That's an ethical responsibility we have.
To meet that responsibility, UTEP uses a sophisticated data center to figure out precise ways to support students. For example, data show that failing a class in the first semester is an early warning sign that a student will have trouble graduating.
So we're trying to find out very early in a student's first semester where they're having difficulty so that we can then intervene. Is it a fiscal, financial issue? Do we provide them some financial assistance? Is it a tutoring need? Are they just not understanding the topic of conversation? Is it a transportation need? And we find students who miss class because they're taking the bus and it takes them an hour and a half to get here, and how can we help them, you know, with those areas? And so, you know, having that information is the first thing.
The school keeps track of how students are doing before they even enroll at UTEP, starting in grade school. It's part of a larger effort that includes the school districts and the community college.
We're isolated. We're a closed community. And so it wasn't about pointing fingers anymore, where the college points fingers at the schools and says, well, you're not preparing the students the way you need to do. And the school's pointing fingers at us saying, well, the teachers that are teaching in our school come from your university, so it's your fault. It's sort of like you can keep pointing fingers or you can fix the problem and realize that we're all in this together.
That was Gary Edens, Vice President of Student Affairs at the University of Texas, El Paso. You also heard one of my guests for this hour, Lori Stern, as reporter on that piece. It is all part of a new American Radio Works documentary called The New Face of College, which airs on KERA 90.1 this Sunday at 5. We also have the documentary's lead producer with us, Samara Freemark. You know, I really like a lot of that clip, and the fact that it ends, Lori, with the idea that folks at UTEP started looking at themselves and the challenges their students faced and realizing that communication is important not only with people who are working at the university, but Dr. Diana Natalicio, who is president of UTEP, meets on a regular basis with administrators from the community college system and also the K-12 systems in the El Paso area.
It really makes you wonder why more communities aren't doing this. It's super integrated. It's super student focused. It's about lifting all boats in El Paso and making the highest possible degree amount of education accessible. And I'm familiar with other communities where there is finger pointing, and the higher education institutions are competitive with each other. And I think it's this cooperation and shared sense of mission that makes UTEP as hopeful and successful as it is.
Yeah, if I could add to that really quickly, as Lori was saying, I think at a lot of schools, a lot of colleges, there's sort of the sense that primary and secondary education is not preparing students to go to college, and there's a bit of a resentment about that, like an anger of, why are you sending us these students who are not prepared to do our coursework? And especially as the population of college goers changes, I think that's just a very short-sighted way to look at your new students. And it's refreshing to see a school that is sort of taking that as part of their mission instead of just blaming the public education system.
And to just take it a step further, they, you know, one of the questions that I had for everybody I talked to there is this unique to El Paso because it is such a tightly knit, particular, and rather isolated community, or could this happen in other communities? And the answer was always, this is replicable. You just have to know who you want to serve, and then you can figure out how to serve them. I forgot what I was going to say, but I'll
wonder
remember
if
shortly.
In part, it works in El Paso because so many people who are educated there have a deep desire to remain in the community. And so it seems to make sense to the entire community to invest those resources in educating students there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I came across one article, I think it was from Forbes, that said El Paso actually had the highest income growth, among the highest income growth for metropolitan areas in the nation. And it didn't break down what UTEP's role in that was, but it's notable. And it's partly because El Paso started so low for median income. But it's right. It's a place where people are very connected to their families, whether they're whichever side of the border they're on, and they very much feel a sense of commitment to the area and to improving their home. There's a tension too, because it's a research institution and the graduates are offered positions at global companies and in other cities. There's some concern about brain drain, but that's a pretty healthy tension to have.
I mean, there's just all kinds of research that shows when you inject more people with BAs into a community, all kinds of outcomes improve. I think crime goes down, teen pregnancies go down, incomes go up. And so I think it's really important for universities to see themselves as a really crucial part of the larger ecosystem of communities.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Rajis in Dallas. Hi, Rajis.
Hi. My comment is around the big discussion that's going on about how the student debt is piling up. While I see statistically and numerically you can see that debt is piling up, and then when I visit campuses, and I've got nephews and nieces in different campuses, and the amount of spending that they do, frivolous spending on everything from clothing to drinking to enjoying their life versus focusing on the school, is there no responsibility that has to be put on the people who are actually spending that versus all the taxpayers that who are being blamed or being told to bail that out?
Lori and Samara, any thoughts?
So I think, first of all, it's hard to deny that costs of college have gone up really dramatically. Even in the past 10 years, I think total student borrowing has more than doubled. I think it's like at $113 billion now. So the costs of college have gone way up. It's also hard to argue that schools aren't building, they are spending a lot of money on facilities. And the reason they're doing that is because there's this arm race going on for new students. They're really trying to, all colleges are in competition with each other to attract new students. And this is particularly true because the number of high school students in the pipeline is actually going down for the first time in about a decade. And so colleges are competing for sort of a shrinking pool of students. And the way that a lot of them have chosen to compete is by making their campuses super fancy, filling them with amenities. I think it is important to note that actually I don't think the biggest thing driving the cost of college right now is actually the amenities, even though that's what you see. I think it actually has to do more with there's been a big drop in public investment in education, and schools have lost a lot of state funding, and they've passed on those hits to the students. So that's the big driver of why tuition is going up. But I think this goes a bit to what we were talking about earlier about what the purpose of college is. Is it so that you can spend 4 years hanging out with your friends? It's sort of something that feels a bit like a luxury hotel, or is it to really learn skills that will make you valuable in the job market?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Henry on the line next in Dallas. Hi, Henry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to make a quick comment, just share a story, something that happened to me. I'm a first-generation high school graduate, college graduate, and then had a decent job. You know, I had to take out loans for my undergrad, which was fine. They were subsidized, most of them. Then I found myself unemployed, and so I wanted to go to grad school. So I applied to grad school, got in, and was unaware that apparently, well, not only is it just unbelievably expensive, that as far as I can tell, there are no subsidies for graduate student loans. And So I think they hit me with like 7.9% interest rate. And then there's a two-year program. I got a year in, and they found a blip on my credit and cut my financial aid, and I was forced to drop out. And so now I'm saddled with a number that I won't share because it's ridiculous, in student loan debt at ridiculous interest rates that I can't pay, and I don't have my degree. So,
well, I'm sorry to hear that story, Henry. I know that the doc focuses mostly on undergraduate students, but I wonder if you looked at financing for graduate programs.
Well, my expertise is at UTEP, and while I think that there are graduate students are expected to pay tuition, I know that as a research university, UTEP makes every effort to not just subsidize graduate students, but employ them in research labs on campus. So I'm curious about where Henry went for graduate school. I did that too. I became unemployed and went to graduate school and got a graduate assistantship that paid my way. So it was functional for me too. I think that's probably a good and typical use of graduate school. And if Henry's still on the line, I'd be curious whether he chose a public or private institution or what the circumstance was.
Where did you go to school, Henry?
I don't know if I should say. It's one of the – they may or may not sponsor this show.
Well, I think everybody can take three guesses there. It's all right. So it's a private school is what you're telling me.
No, it's UTD.
Okay. University of Texas at Dallas is what he was saying. So it was a public university.
Yeah, I mean, this is an outcome. This happens to a lot of people. I mean, there are numbers that say, you know, again, on average, higher education is a good payoff. I think now a college degree gives you, minus the costs of it, on average, I think about $500,000 additional income over the course of your life. I'm not positive about those numbers, but it's something like that. But again, those are average numbers, and they don't apply to everybody. And certainly I have heard many stories of people getting trapped in educational debt. I mean, especially if it's that high interest loan debt.
So I was really fascinated about the parts of the doc that focus on Amherst College, which is, you know, a highly elite school, but has made a concerted effort over the past several years to recruit a much more diverse body of students.
Yeah, so Amherst, when I was applying for schools, Amherst was kind of as blue blood as it gets. You know, when I thought I didn't even apply to Amherst because my impressions of it were just that it was full of rich white guys playing lacrosse, basically. That might be unfair to Amherst. But they, over the past decade or so, they have really just totally made this huge, unprecedented effort to, first of all, attract non-traditional students and then really serve them in a real way. You know, Amherst was, you know, it was all male until 1975. And, you know, it started using affirmative action in the 1970s. But then in the early 2000s, they hired this new president named Tony Marks, who believed that it wasn't enough to say that you were going to be diverse. You had to put your money where your mouth was. And he launched this huge fundraising campaign. He raised $500 million. A large part of that went to recruit and serve students who were diverse, both economically and ethnically. And today, I think 43% of Amherst students identify as students of color. 22% receive Pell Grants, which is much lower than, it should be said, much lower than at a place like UTEP. But when you compare it to small, elite private schools, it's very high. And if you look at the cost of Amherst, this is where Amherst really shines. Amherst costs, for a student without aid, I believe it costs $54,000. If your family makes less than $30,000 on average, you pay $448.
Wow,
that is significantly less than at any other private elite institution. I mean, $448 is almost nothing. One thing that I find really interesting about Amherst is it wasn't they didn't just decide to start giving a lot of financial aid. I mean, that was an important first step to get the kids to your campus. But there was kind of this iterative process that happened at Amherst where as these students started arriving in larger and larger numbers, the school was very open to sort of assessing where it was failing them. So there are these nice little stories at Amherst. For example, a couple of years into the program, into the decision to really attract these students, the administration realized that the school shuts down for Thanksgiving break. You know, for 10 days, the school basically shuttered its doors. And they realized that these students had nowhere to go for those 10 days. They couldn't afford to go home, and they had nowhere to eat, basically. And so the school decided to keep their cafeteria open during Thanksgiving break. You know, they realized that students were coming and they couldn't afford to buy a winter coat if they were coming from, you know, from a warmer place. And so they started giving students, when they first arrived on campus, a stipend of, I think, $400 to do stuff like buy a lamp, buy a winter coat, buy bedding for your bed. I think they really focused on getting students to as level a playing field at the beginning as they could. They pay medical expenses. They pay for students to fly home twice a year. So there are just all these little things that are actually not so little if you are showing up at an elite, at one of the most elite schools in the country, and you're coming from, say, rural Alabama. These things are, you can feel very unwelcome on a campus if you feel that you're so different from the other students right from the get-go. And that's really where Amherst is now, is they feel like they've solved the access part of the puzzle. You know, they've got a lot of kids coming in who do not look like the standard Amherst student. Now they're really working on the success part. Like, how do we make these students feel at home? How do we make sure they graduate at the same rates? And they've been very successful at that.
We're speaking this hour with Samara Freemark and Lori Stern about their new American Radio Works documentary, The New Face of College. It will air Sunday, September 28th at 5 o'clock in the evening on KERA 90.1. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
It's the end of the school year, and Valeria has just brought an envelope over to her dad's place. A surprise. She asked her stepmom to shoot a cell phone video of his reaction. I have a decision that affects all of us, she says. Let's have it, says her dad. Open it, she says, open it. I know, you're pregnant, says her dad. He opens the outer envelope. Her stepmom is in on the joke. She says, it's a bill. Valeria's dad's eyes widen as he reads the note. Then they tear up. You graduated, he says. She corrects him. I graduate in May. She tells him this is their invitation to come to the ceremony. In the video, her dad swats her with the envelope playfully. And then they hug for a long time.
That is a scene from the new American Radio Works documentary, The New Face of College, which airs Sunday, September 28th at 5 o'clock. We're speaking this hour with two of its producers, Lori Stern and Samara Freemark. Lori Stern, how many times did you have to go through that copy so that you could say it without choking up yourself?
Oh, it was just such a privilege to get to know Valeria and the professor who mentored her. It took several days of spending a lot of time with them. The last day I was in El Paso was the day that we were going to go hiking in the mountains. And when I got to the geology lab, she was showing her professor that video. I hadn't known anything about it. And then when we were out prospecting in the mountains, she started talking more about what it was like to have been raised with low expectations, because there wasn't a lot of college graduation or academic success in her family. And so we had the opportunity to talk about it when we got back from the mountain, and that's what you heard.
It is extraordinary. It seems that people who have not maybe had to struggle to get a good education aren't aware of the many small things that can get in the way and make it much, much harder to graduate beyond, as we were talking about in the last segment, simply the issues of having the money to pay for an education.
Right. So for Valeria, there was, as with so many of the students we all met, there was family support for the idea of going to college, but very little understanding of what that would actually mean. In Valeria's case, she didn't have a lot of mission, a sense of mission. She was kind of a wild teenager. She said she nearly dropped out of high school. She enrolled in El Paso Community College because a lot of people, the most successful people in her family, are healthcare workers, and she thought that's what she would wind up doing. She quickly figured out she couldn't stand the sight of blood, and she got interested in rocks, which maybe are the opposite of blood. I don't know. But in the meantime, she met the man she married. But before she married him, she was pregnant, and she was 18 or 19 when she had her son. She stopped out for a while to raise him in his first few months, and she was inspired by her husband, who was also a first generation college goer, born in Mexico, who not only got his BA at UTEP, but went on and got his professional nursing degree there, and is now a nurse at a hospital and a nursing instructor at EPCC. So Valeria wants to keep going. She's in the master's program this year. She expects to have the opportunity to go prospecting around the world. She's interested in gems. And she says her ultimate goal is to come back to El Paso and teach at UTEP.
Yeah, just adding to that, this idea of what it means to go to college as a first-generation student, if your family has not done that. The admissions director at Heritage University told me that there are just so many ways that a college student needs to be supported that you wouldn't think of if you come from a family that's really familiar with higher education. I mean, even things like having a place to study. She said a lot of the students she works with, you know, as I said, the student body at Heritage is mostly the children of immigrants. And for them, you know, for that culture, when you're at work, you're at work. And when you're at home, you're hanging out with your family, you're cooking, you're playing with the kids. You're not going into a room and closing the door and studying. And that's exactly what you need to do if you're a college student. And so if you come from a family and you live with a family who doesn't understand that, it becomes very, very difficult to even have the opportunity to do the work you need to do to be successful at school.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Carlos in Dallas. Hi, Carlos.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank
you. Good
morning.
I guess good afternoon, depending on where you are. Mm-hmm. Well, my comment was that the idea of deferral of student loans is really not a help for students. My son deferred his loans for about 3 years, some of his loans for about 3 years while he was still in college, and he ended up with another $4,000 worth of debt because the interest kept accumulating. So I think a reduction of interest rate might be a way to help the students, but certainly not deferring them.
Thanks so much for your call. Certainly finding ways to finance a college education remains challenging, and this is something that I know you're both aware of. It sounds like students, like schools rather, are trying to get more involved than they historically were in providing maybe paths for school finance. Is that accurate?
I think that's right. And I think a very interesting thing that institutions and parents are watching is what the Obama administration is going to put out in terms of, they call it the college report card. But they talk about it both as a consumer issue and kind of as an accreditation issue. So they have said that they will evaluate schools in terms of their access, affordability, and effectiveness, and they want to incent more non-traditional students to succeed in school. That's their goal. But some of the ways they talk about ranking schools or evaluating schools are not sitting very well with some of the institutions that we visited for this documentary. For example, several of the college presidents we talked to have a real problem with the way graduation rates are calculated because they only include first-time, full-time students entering freshmen. So at UTEP, for example, 70% of the kids of the I shouldn't say kids because many of them are adults. Of the graduates, I think there were something like 2,700 who got their BAs last spring. 70% of them were not reflected in UTEP's graduation rate, which is on the books at 38%. And that's because maybe they transferred in, maybe they took longer than 6 years because they had to step out to raise children or support an ailing family member, or who knows what reason. And President Natalicio makes a very strong argument that that metric needs to change to measure degree completion and not what it measures now. And to the extent that federal financial aid will be tied to some kind of degree completion or graduation rate metric, there's a lot at stake for these schools and these students.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Joshua on the line in Arlington. Hi, Joshua.
Hello. I've been teaching in university since the mid-90s, and I try to take students wherever they're starting from. That's the point at which we began, and I'm mainly interested in effort and in terms of evaluation. However, I think what I found in the last couple of years is university teachers are feeling a bit pinched. On the one hand, there are increasingly students who are less well-prepared than in the past, and yet university administrations require retention, right, or pushing retention. And I'm curious, from what I've heard so far of the documentary, I'm not sure if that pressure, I guess, on teachers is something that is brought to the fore. I'm just curious, in your documentary, in your work at UTEP, did you find the same pressure on faculty members?
Joshua, I'm glad you brought that up, not least because it reminded me of the point I wanted to make about half an hour ago. yes and no. What you describe is something I've heard at places aside from UTEP. There is so much single-mindedness about retention and also educating who's in your class. I mean, it's just such a mindful thing that they're doing on that campus that I don't think that teachers are really feeling caught in the kind of bind you describe. And what I wanted to say earlier is that places like Amherst and UTEP, which are in some ways flip sides of the coin because of who goes there now and who used to go there, but they are. I mean, it was such a great project to work on because it's so hopeful and it's so American dreamy in ways that, you know, I used to work on the poverty beat and I haven't reported a hopeful story in years. And so the presidents of these two institutions, Biddy Martin at Amherst and Diana Natalicio at UTEP, who are themselves first-generation college goers, they want to take what they're doing on their campuses and participate in a really robust way in a national conversation about how more schools can do that and how they can compile a database of best practices and resources. And there are coalitions forming for say private nonprofits who can share solutions to the problems that Joshua's bringing up.
Yeah, then, and Joshua, I think I'm really glad you brought that up because we don't talk about that as much as we probably could have in the documentary. And I think you're right. I think professors right now are being asked to do really different things than they used to be. You know, for a long time, colleges were judged on how exclusive they were. And that kind of means how many students they didn't let in or how many students didn't get A's. And now some schools are kind of asking their teachers to help everyone succeed. So they're being judged on how many people succeed instead of how many people fail. And it's a very different way of teaching. I spoke at Heritage. I spoke with a chemistry professor who had taught at University of Illinois, a very prestigious chemistry program, before he came to Heritage. And he said, I'm used to teaching to the top 3%. My mandate was to create the next great chemist. And now my job is to serve the 100%. And make sure that all of them succeed. That's a very, very different thing to do. And I think I can imagine as a professor that would be a little head spinning.
What's really interesting is that it doesn't sound like from the reporting that you did that either Amherst or UTEP is less prestigious having gone to the effort to educate a broader cross-section of students.
Yeah, I think Amherst is number 2 in the rankings this year, which is what they've basically always been, bounced around in the top 3. Laura, you want to speak to UTEP?
Yeah, it might also be worth mentioning the rankings because there are a lot of different sets of rankings out there. And right, Amherst has topped the U.S. News and World Report rankings, I don't know for how long, probably decades.
Yeah.
UTEP is down there if you look at U.S. News and World Report, but there's an alternate set of rankings published by Washington Monthly that has UTEP number 1 in social mobility. In other words, taking incoming students from one class and catapulting them to another. And it is, according to Washington Monthly, in the top 10, along with schools like Stanford and Harvard, in overall quality for national universities. I mean, Diana Natalicio's, one of her many sayings is, we succeed because of the students we have, not in spite of the students we have. Hmm. And it's a message she just wants to tell everybody.
Lori Stern and Samara Freemark are producers of the American Radio Works documentary, The New Face of College. You can hear the whole thing when it airs on KERA 90.1 this coming Sunday, September 28th at 5. Thank you both so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. We've really enjoyed it.
Lori and Samara joined us as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can email us at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.